yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. The court has three causes on its oral submission docket this morning. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. CNH Nationwide Incorporated and others versus Linda Gale Thompson and others from Harris County. Granada Corporation and others versus the First Court of Appeals, an original mandamus proceeding. And Remington Arms Company Incorporated versus the Honorable Neil Caldwell Judge and the Honorable Benjamin Martinez Judge, an original mandamus proceeding. In the first and third causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. In the middle cause, the court has allotted 25 minutes. We will take a recess in between the presentation of each of these arguments and will complete all of the arguments before our lunch break. The petitioners and relators may request to reserve a certain portion of their time for rebuttal argument by so advising the marshal of the court. These arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court, and if you desire to listen to an audio tape of the arguments, you may make application with our clerk. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in CNH versus Thompson.
May it please the court, Mr. Randall Wilkins and Mr. James Peden will present argument for petitioners. They've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Peden will open with the first 5 minutes. Excuse me, 7 minutes.
May it please the court, I am Jim Peden. I represent Ecotec International, one of several defendants in the court below, and of course a petitioner here. This case arises out of an automobile accident in which a load of pipe fell off a truck and one of the pipes crashed into a vehicle driven by the decedent, Jerry Wayne Thompson. The defendants included Shell Oil, the owner of the pipe, who settled out of the case completely. The owner-operator of the vehicle involved, here we'll refer to them as CNH Trucking. Energy Coating Company was in coat, in whose facility shortly before this accident the pipe had been coated with an epoxy rosin and loaded onto the truck. My client, Ecotec, worked under a contract with Shell Oil and had the responsibility for monitoring the coating process to make sure it was properly done and monitoring the loading process of the pipe on the truck to make sure that the coating, new coating, was not damaged in that process. I want to turn initially to the point of error on which this court seems to be the most interested, and that is the question of whether or not prejudgment interest should be awarded on future damages. In this particular case, the elements of damage were submitted to the jury in a number of special issues, each of which required the jury to determine combined past and future damages for the various elements and to determine the amount of those damages using the test of if now, that is at the time of trial, paid in cash. Now, in response to those various issues, the jury found approximately $8.2 million worth of damages. After being $6 million in settlement credit, a judgment was entered for the $2.2 million, plus prejudgment interest on the entirety of the $2.2 million. Now, this was done over the objection of the defendants that the prejudgment interest should not have been awarded under the principles that this court had laid down in Kavanaugh on future damages, or more precisely, any of the damages in this case, because the future and past damages had been combined.
Court of Appeals held that Kavanaugh does not apply, and the statute that superseded Kavanaugh, or changed Kavanaugh, really should be our focus.
That is correct, Your Honor. Now, in Kavanaugh, the rationale of the court, I believe, was that the plaintiff, under equitable principles, is entitled to prejudgment interest because to award past damages without that would not fully compensate the plaintiff. In contrast, on future damages, the plaintiff has suffered no loss because the damages have not yet occurred. Therefore, there's no consequential damage from the delay in payment. All right, we turn to the statute. The statute simply says award prejudgment interest on the judgment. It makes no reference to future damages, past damages, or any distinction. Now, clearly this statute was intended to modify Kavanaugh. It certainly did in two ways expressly. One, it changed the interest rate to be used from a compounded, a daily compounding, to a simple interest. It also expressly changed the date from which interest would accrue. If it changed the rule with regard to past versus future damages, it did so only by implication.
Well, in that regard, every court of appeals that has looked at this question, and there have been three of them, have ruled contrary to your position today.
That is correct, Your Honor. I think there are about five cases on the books
now. There are five
now. And in addition, I think we have to recognize the existence of the Montfort-Barber article, which I think is generally regarded as an expression of legislative history.
Well, Mr. Barber has been the chief draftsman for the self-styled partner farmers for many years, hasn't he?
That's correct,
Your Honor. And he's contrary to your position.
In that article, he expresses the purpose or the purpose perceived by Mr. Barber and Mr. Montfort as they see this statute. Now, I think the question, though, that we have here is whether it is constitutionally permissible to permit the award of prejudgment interest on future damages.
Well, I'd like to ask you about that, but just so it's clear, there's no doubt in your mind that Mr. Barber, the chief draftsman for the TARP reform forces, interprets this statute exactly the opposite of the way you interpret it.
There is no doubt in my mind that he so reads it in an opposite fashion.
That in addition, and I guess I was mistaken, didn't know about a couple of new cases, five courts of appeals, and then also the State Bar Pattern Jury Charge Committee, made up of both, I guess, across the bar of different types of lawyers, they read it the opposite of the way you read it.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And with reference then to whether, despite the conclusion, well, has anyone reached the same conclusion you have? Is there any commentator looking at this statute that has interpreted it the way you have, or any court anywhere?
Yes, Your Honor. There are two federal court cases, federal district court cases coming out of the Eastern District of Texas. They are cited in our brief, the Cimino cases. They're both written by the same judge, and the second follows the first.
Okay.
And that was our first court to write on the issue and concluded that Kavanaugh had been unchanged by the statute.
As far as your constitutional argument is concerned, I couldn't find any authority in your brief or your, I guess, co-defendant's brief in support of that. Is there any case cited?
There are no cases, no Texas cases. None of these five cases or several cases in Texas have considered the constitutional aspects of this statute.
And it's what I'm interested in focusing in on now is your briefing, because as I looked at your brief, and compared it to the interpretive method that this court has set out in Edgewood 3 and in Davenport concerning how you analyze a constitutional provision, I couldn't see that you've done any of that. No cases, no history.
Basically, Your Honor, there are no cases to cite. We have the statute. We simply make the contention that it is a denial of substantive due process to award prejudgment interest on future damages where there is no factor of compensation involved. In order to pass a substantive due process test, there must be some sort of a rational basis for the rule being imposed. Now, with regard to past damages, there is a rational basis. There is a compensatory basis. And as an additional salutary effect, I think, of the decision to award prejudgment interest on future damages, there was the encouragement of settlement, the encouragement to expedite the trial process. But that came only after the compensatory justification. On future damages, there is no compensatory justification. It is simply a taking of the defendant's money and putting it in the plaintiff's pocket, and in effect as a penalty. And that penalty is imposed without any regard for the good faith, bad faith conduct of the defendant in the case.
The legislature could have easily allowed for penalty damage.
I don't know that it could have, Your Honor. I think we then come back and meet the same argument. Is it reasonable to impose a penalty on a defendant for a failure to settle? What could the legislature do? Should it pass a bill that said any defendant who fails to settle and ultimately have a judgment taken against it will have to pay three times without regard to any culpability on the part of the defendant? I don't think that would pass a substantive due process test either.
Are you aware of any treble damage provisions that have been struck down on due process grounds like our old
the former Deceptive Trade Practices Act with its absolute rule and the absolute rules of...
No, Your Honor, what I have to...
Antitrust Act.
What I have to rely on are those areas where there are multiple or additional damages allowed, and they are done on the basis of either intentional or knowing conduct. You know, the things that come to mind are obviously the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, antitrust laws.
But that's a modern amendment.
I beg your pardon, Your Honor?
The Trade Practices Act is just a relatively recent amendment.
Yes, Your Honor, it was. And to my knowledge, there was no constitutional challenge, or at least certainly no successful constitutional challenge, to the old treble damage provisions of the Act. Your Honor, my time is up. I am impeding on the time of my co-defendant.
Are there any further questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Please report. My name is Randall Wilkins, and I represent the CNA in this case. I would like to start to cut off. Justice Daugherty is correct. We strictly followed the admonition and the rules that brief be brief on this particular point. Since it was the only point granted, I'm contemplating doing that in all my future briefs, but I do want to cite the court to LaCroix v. Hanlon, LaCroix v. Hanlon, H-A-N-L-O-N, 713 Southwest 2nd, 335. That's a case out of this court in 1986 in which it struck down a court fee provision for which plaintiffs had to pay upon filing their cases because it allowed the money to go into the general fund of the state treasury as opposed to simply assisting the court. This court held that was a violation of the open courts provision of the Texas Constitution, which is Section 13 of Article 1. I would submit to the court that Section 13 is basically the plaintiff seeking access to the courts, it's their open courts provision. The due process clause under Section 19 is what makes sure that the defendants get their day in court. It basically says you can't take away their property without due process of law. I would submit that the analysis in LaCroix v. Hanlon would apply. And it basically was a balancing test as to the imposition imposed upon plaintiffs, imposed upon their rights to have their day in court versus the purpose or intent of the statute, whether there was a rational relationship. And they said, since the purpose of the fee was not to assist the court system, but simply to go into the general treasury of the state, and impermissibly imposed upon the rights of plaintiffs to go into court. I would submit that same sort of balancing test is permissible by this court. LaCroix v. Hanlon also points out it was not bound by the due process or any other constitutional analysis under the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments, which may have been promulgated by the Supreme Court. That is, it doesn't put a ceiling on this court to grant additional or more extensive rights than are granted by the United States Supreme Court. Now, this court can make an analysis similar to the court being handled in this case, and it must look at basically the purposes of tort reform. The first purpose, as I understand, tort reform, was to increase fairness in the system. Senator Mumford, in the Law Review article, which I'm sure you already know, but it's 25 Houston Law Review 59, it was a 1988 article, at page 104, Senator Mumford states flat out, he says, shortening of the accrual period promotes the policies of tort reform laws, while applicability to future damages does not. So if Senator Mumford is indeed the authority on this statute, he's admitted that the imposition of prejudgment interest on future damages that haven't even accrued yet, does not promote tort reform, does not promote the interest of the statute, does not promote the purposes of tort reform. And I think on the next page, on 105, he states that it was basically an accommodation. It promotes the interest of plaintiffs. So from that aspect, I think this court should make an analysis. There has to be more than simply promoting the purpose of the statute. I suppose the legislature could pass a law that says the losing party faces a firing squad, and that would probably promote settlements. It might work better if the attorney for the losing party had to face a firing squad, but that wouldn't be rational. Now, this is obviously a lot lower penalty than facing a firing squad, but this court can engage in that kind of analysis to determine to weigh and see if the purpose of this penalty, and that's all it is rationally related, and is it rationally related in that it's not arbitrary and it's not capricious. I think my time, I think from the green light means my 8 minutes, my initial time is up. I'm sorry.
Counsel, don't we have to start with the words of the statute itself?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, we don't immediately go into trying to figure out whether Senator Mumford or any other member of the legislature, what they tried to do. We have to look at the words of the statute first, don't we?
That's correct.
And does this statute suggest that, make any suggestion that unaccrued damages might bear interest?
Well, it says the interest will be on the amount of the judgment. And
that's no change in Texas law, is it? The amount of the interest to be on the interest to be accrue on the amount of the judgment.
As to pre-judgment interest, it is not as to post-judgment interest.
Well, it doesn't make any distinction, does it?
No, it doesn't, and that's why it's been interpreted by some commentators to allow it on pre-judgment interest. We're simply arguing that if it is interpreted in that fashion to allow it on unaccrued damages, that it's arbitrary and capricious. This court has the right to make that analysis. And it certainly doesn't facilitate the other interest which would be involved with compensating plaintiffs if a plaintiff hasn't been harmed by unaccrued damages. My red light's on. I'll sit down and let you throw the question.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from our respondents.
Mr. Dale Harville and Mr. Lee Kaplan will present argument for respondents. Mr. Kaplan will take the first 10 minutes.
May it please the court, my name is Lee Kaplan from Houston. I represent Energy Coatings, one of the defendants in the trial court. I have been aligned as a respondent. As a matter of fact, our client is a petitioner with respect to the prejudgment interest matter, and I believe the court would like to hear more from the true respondent on that issue. So I will state only that I am a respondent, particularly as to another issue raised in the briefing by CNH.
Right, you say you're a petitioner on prejudgment.
Well,
we didn't actually file.
We did not assign that as a point of error, Your Honor.
As to the point of error we particularly granted on,
We have no argument. That is right, Your Honor. We are here as a respondent primarily on an argument made by CNH which calls for an absurd interpretation of the statute. And that basically is a question which under CNH's interpretation would say that Energy Coatings, the least culpable defendant in this case as found by the jury, would not be entitled to any credit for the two separate settlements made in this case, each for $3 million. One was the total settlement by Shell, another for $3 million. The other for $3 million was made by CNH. It was a partial settlement in which CNH capped its actual damage liability at $8.5 million, eliminated punitive damage liability, and arranged for a veto power over any other settlements. The Court of Appeals, as well as the trial court, found that that, too, was a settlement. The trial court and the Court of Appeals found that that should, in fact, be treated as a credit elected by all defendants under Section 33.012 of the statute. If the court has any questions about this, I'm available to answer them. I think our brief discusses that in full.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Dale Harville, and I represent the Thompsons in this matter. First, I would go to the statute 5069-1056A, And it says that a judgment must include prejudgment interest after September 2nd of 1987. This case falls after that date. Prejudgment interest accrues on the amount of the judgment. The judgment makes, as judgment generally in Texas have always, to my knowledge, done, it makes no distinction between future elements of damage in that judgment and past elements of damages in that judgment. With respect to post-judgment interest, post-judgment interest has been permitted on future damages as far back as I know, and those damages have not accrued yet either. Post-judgment, except as they come to pass, but what happens is the judgment itself accrues those future damages. And the courts have always permitted.
Future damages have not been accrued when the judgment is signed?
The judgment itself does that, sir.
But the jury was asked what sum of money, if paid now in cash, would fairly and reasonably compensate the plaintiff for injuries to be sustained in the future.
That's exactly correct, sir.
So the payment now in cash, isn't that an accrual?
It could be so interpreted as an accrual, sir. Sure could. What I'm saying is, prejudgment interest should be treated no differently than post-judgment interest. They come under the same statute. Prejudgment interest accrues these quote-unquote unaccrued future damages by the judgment, certainly, or as you suggest, the verdict itself may indeed accrue those damages. The U.S. Supreme Court, the highest courts of other states, all of the Texas cases, and I only know of three that are reported myself. I stand corrected if there are two others reported. But all of the cases that I know of from U.S. Supreme Court on down have held that prejudgment interest is something particularly to be... Excuse me, I just lost the cat. Sorry. Prejudgment interest is something that has been forever upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, by all courts in Texas that have ruled on the subject, by the courts of other states. I know of no case that has ever held that a prejudgment interest statute is unconstitutional as violating substantive due process of law. These have always been held.
You cite a lot of cases in your brief. Do any of those deal with prejudgment interest on future damages?
Yes, sir, they do. I believe that the Fleming versus Baptist General Hospital out of the Supreme Court of Oklahoma does. I believe that Massachusetts Benefit Association versus Miles does. U.S. Supreme Court case, and of course the Texas case is cited here, dude. But this court in footnote 2 of Kavanaugh cites this Funkhauser U.S. Supreme Court case, which holds that this is particularly within the discretion of the legislature to determine what will go by way of prejudgment interest to judgments. So I submit to you that the constitutional argument made here is without any merit, and we ask this court to so hold. With respect to past and future damages, as I say, they should be treated the same under the same statute in accordance with Barr versus Barnhart out of this court that says that one provision of statute will not be given a meaning out of harmony or inconsistent with other provisions, even though it might be susceptible to such construction if standing alone. Here, post-judgment interest, there are a number of cases that have held even where it's not pleaded, and even where no objection to a judgment has been made and the judgment itself did not include post-judgment interest, that it is given by this statute mandatorily as a matter of right. We submit to this honorable court that pre-judgment interest under the same statute should be treated the same way. What we quarrel with here about it is that pre-judgment interest was started May the 18th of 1988 rather than November the 20th of 1987. We also feel that under Cavender that a decedent's estate was entitled to be started at the date of death, not 6 months later. And we submit this is clear, era, and that the prejudgment interest should indeed be started at the time that is mandated by the statute. In other words, the statute doesn't say you're entitled to that if you object or if you do this or that. It says that the judgment must, and that the language of the statute, I submit, is very important. It must include prejudgment interest, and it must be as stated in the statute. Either the date suit is filed or 6 months, 180 days after notice. So we ask the court to so hold here that my clients are entitled to prejudgment interest, just like post-judgment interest, from the date that the statute sets out, which is would be from November the 20th of 1987 to January 22nd of 1990, and then post-judgment interest from January 23rd, the date of the judgment, as modified by the court, to the date that is paid. We submit that the Court of Appeals was an era when it failed to permit prejudgment interest on the quote-unquote payments made by Shell and CNH. We say that is error because in denying the Thompsons recovery of prejudgment interest, it denies an element of compensation to the plaintiffs recognized by the legislature. It gives credit to the other parties, the non-settlers, more than a dollar-for-dollar credit, contrary to 33.0112 of the Practice and Remedies Code. Rule 301 is violated. It doesn't give the plaintiffs all the relief that they're entitled to. And it also violates Article 5069.105, and that only the prevailing party is entitled to prejudgment interest. Non-settlers are given interest on settlers' money from the date of payment. No statutory basis for it frustrates the encouragement of settlement and frustrates the purposes as laid out both in the legislative history and by Cabinet. We submit that it's wrong not to permit prejudgment interest to the date of those payments to the Thompsons here, and we ask the court to so rule. Non-settlers are adequately protected by 33.012, by the dollar-for-dollar credit, by the contribution provisions in that series of statutes, by the apportionment of responsibility, and the tolling of prejudgment interest on offers made of settlement. Statute doesn't say if you make an offer of settlement, you wipe out your payment of prejudgment interest to the date you make that offer. The payment by another party shouldn't wipe out these parties, the non-settlers, requirement to pay prejudgment interest to the date of those payments. And we also would submit that giving Ecotec and Inco credit for the payment by CNH violates the collateral source rule as announced in Caner versus Walker, and we ask the court to so hold. Thank you very much. If any questions, I'll be happy to try to answer them if I can keep my bridge on long enough.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, sir.
May I please the court, Mr. Beaton,
forward us that fourth and fifth case that you referenced?
Yes, Your Honor. If you give me just a moment here.
Okay.
I think what we have is five, including this one, if that's some help to you.
Right.
CTW versus BCG,
Walmart
Sisters
case.
Of Charity, Walmart Stores versus Berry.
Right.
That's a case that where an application, I believe, is pending before this court. And then Hughes versus Thrash. That's at 832 Southwest 2nd, 779. It's out of the 1st District in Houston. There does not appear to have been a rehearing in that case, so I doubt that you'll see it. It's a June 18, 1992 decision.
Counsel, would you respond briefly to Mr. Harville's argument that courts below started the interest running on the wrong date pursuant to the terms of the new statute?
Yes, Your Honor. Quite frankly, I believe the statute does read as Mr. Harville contends it does, in that interest should commence upon proper request and objection on the earlier of the date suit is filed or 6 months after a written notice. I think my response to Mr. Harville's argument that he is entitled to that date in this case is that he did not ask for it. He had two chances to do so. This case, the court first entered a judgment which included prejudgment interest on the amounts paid in settlement. The defendants objected to that. Now, that same judgment provided for a calculation of interest from 6 months after the date suit was filed. There was no objection from the plaintiffs on that. A second judgment was subsequently entered, the one from which the appeal was taken, which corrected the first by deleting the prejudgment interest on the settlement amounts, but it did not change the date of accrual. Again, there was no objection to that judgment. So I think what we have here is a problem under Rule 52A of the Rules of Appellate Procedure. You have to object in the trial court to preserve your error unless you have some sort of fundamental error, and I don't believe this is fundamental error. You've got a contractual statutory right if you assert that right, but here it was not asserted. For a case that holds, though, in a different context, you've got the All Right Parking case that is cited in our brief. So I believe any right to an additional 6 months of prejudgment interest has been waived. On the argument that the Court of Appeals erred in holding that you could not get prejudgment interest on settlement amounts, I think we may be arguing over what the word judgment includes in the prejudgment interest statute. But it is clear that the judgment does not include amounts paid in settlement. Section 33.012 of the Practice and Remedies Code requires the deduction of settlement amounts from the damage findings. Lastly, on this prejudgment interest on future damages question, picking up on a comment by Justice Heck, the jury found prejudgment interest on future damage found damages as they existed at the date of trial. Now consider this hypothetical of the perfect world where you've got a case with nothing but future damages. If the jury were to find the damages as of the date of the injury, that should be, by reason of discounting, a lower figure than would be found by the jury on the date of trial sometime later, simply because of a difference in the discount. By increasing the amount of future damages awarded at the time of trial over those which would have been awarded at the time of the injury, you have doubly compensated the plaintiff if you allow them, in addition to that, prejudgment interest.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. Does that conclude the time? Does anybody have any questions of Mr. Wilkins?
I have some more questions.
You can send it in a letter brief.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument and the first call. The court will now take a brief recess.
Yeah, please rise.